We're back with Malcolm Gladwell. Bill Russell and I are at The New Yorker with him in New York City, Times Square, which is how most people think of power. Big cities, big people accumulated, big money, big. But you're saying that you've seen another part of the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
Say some more about this thing with women. That's very striking.
Well, this is something that came to me a couple of years ago. It comes from my mother.
I was going to ask you how your mother felt about this.
My mother is 70 years old. 60, I'm sorry, 69 years old.
Be very careful, Malcolm.
although she's not a woman who's sensitive about her age. But nonetheless, I shouldn't be adding gears to her life.
She'll take care of that.
none of us need that.
And I was thinking about what she has been through in the course of her life. And I thought, you know, there has never been a generation of people who have been through more in their lifetime than women who are now in their middle age.
Yes. Well, she would then have been born, just to place us in time, in 1931,
something like that.
Okay.
So in the space of her lifetime, the role of women in the world has been turned upside down, upheaval, and no other woman, or I think no other member of any specific generation, male or female, has seen so much happen in her life. So I said to myself, you know, journalism is essentially written about older men and younger women. If you look, it's really interesting to do. I did this. Take a stack of magazines and go through, and you will find 90% of the subjects of stories are either men over 40 or women under 30.
There's sex in here somewhere.
So I said to myself, I am going to write stories about the most interesting generation in history, middle-aged women. So I went on this whole...
Is that how you found Lois?
That's how I found... Lois was part... I went for about a year and a half at The New Yorker. I basically wrote about nothing but middle-aged women. It was so much
fun.
Did
anybody notice?
Strangely, no. No one sort of put it together. But I was at my little hobby horse, my little campaign. So Lois Weisberg was the final woman in this long... Was she the last? Yes, she was the last in this string of stories I did about women in their 60s and 70s. And in many ways, she was the kind of apotheosis. And it was doing that story that made me realize there's an additional reason. These women haven't just been overlooked because of, you know, who they are, but they've also been overlooked because they represent a dimension of authority, influence that we have chosen to ignore in this society because we're wrapped up in these formal notions about what where it's really power and influence where they lie.
Do you take that forth and say that other cultures do recognize this? Or do you care?
Well, I'm not sure. I suspect that this is something... I know this is something that runs through the West. I don't presume to speak for other cultures that I'm not as familiar with. I suspect that other cultures have done a better job once you get outside of the West.
But you're saying developing nations share this. Developed nations.
I think it's true throughout the Western world that there people have been... you know, we haven't seen around... You know, if we go to Germany, you know, the banks aren't being run by... middle-aged women. I mean, you know, well,
before we get beyond that, it is very interesting to me. You say middle-aged women, 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when middle age started at 30.
I know, yes.
35.
Well, my definition of middle age rises with the age of my mother. When my mother is 85, I'll refer to 85 as middle age.
But there is a very important happening in that. Mm-hmm. That our whole society is aging, and even what we think of as middle age.
Yeah.
Has changed.
Well, that generation, I mean, to me, the truly ignored and interesting generation is the generation of women who were born either right around the Second World War or in the decade before it.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, those are the ones who saw, the women who were coming of age in the late 40s, 50s, when all of the turmoil started to begin. Those are the people who, to me, have incredible stories to tell. And in the, you know, when I was in my middle age, do my series of stories on middle-aged women. Some of the stories, it amazed me. My favorite one was, I did a story on the women who came up with the hair color campaigns. Does She or Doesn't She, Only Your Hairdresser Knows for Sure, which was made up by a woman, created by a woman named Shirley Polakoff, one of the greats in American advertising, an extraordinary woman. And then I also wrote about the woman.
And 50 years later, we still remember that.
We still remember it, yeah.
Unbelievable.
And I think that's one of the... in the story, I argued that campaign and the campaign that was created by a woman named Alone Specht, the L'Oreal Because I'm Worth It campaign, which again, I think is a pivotal... That those two women, they actually have as much to do with feminism as the intellectuals and the philosophers and the musicians who we normally talk about the creation of feminism. But there was a third woman who I wrote about in that story, whose name was Herta Herzog. And Herta Herzog was educated at the University of Vienna, came to America in the 40s and was one of the kind of, in the 40s on Madison Avenue, all the ad firms had these staff psychoanalysts, and she was one of them. And she created much of what we now know as market research.
And you're not joking. These really were people trained in psychoanalysis.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the same, she was living with
Anna Freud's generation.
Freud, I mean, these are people who were, they were, some of them were analyzed by Freud. I mean, they were from that. And her, the thing that blew me away about her is that I went to visit her. She's still alive. She lives in Austria. I took a look at the picture of the Christmas party from the early 50s at, and I've forgotten the name of her ad agency, one of the big Madison Avenue, McCann Erickson. It was held in the Waldorf Astoria. Everyone's wearing black tie. There's 300 people in the room. And there is one woman, and that was Herta Herzog.
Wow.
To be that one woman who could break into that closed male world, you had to be remarkable. And that's made me think, you know, this woman's got to have an incredible story to tell.
And you were right.
I think so. She was remarkable.
I think I recall correctly, you used to be a science writer and a business writer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a great deal of talk in science about nonlinear effects and network effects, and there's been a lot of talk in economics about network effects, and both looking at new variants of that. And what you're describing in the work you've done for The New Yorker and in your book is another variation. Mm-hmm. And a very strong variance, a social equivalent of those network effects. Did you do that consciously, or do you think that has something changed in our perceptions or in the way the world operates, or are we just waking up again?
Well, I suppose I did it consciously. I mean, I'm fascinated with the work that you described in mathematics and economics and such, but I don't really understand it because I don't have that kind of mind. And so the way that I can make sense of it is to translate it into social and human terms. And that's really what I was trying to do in the book, that there is, you're right, there is this wonderful work in nonlinear, you know, dynamics, which is unfortunately beyond the ken of 98% of us. And I happen to be part of the 98%.
So is that the part about how my mind works?
And, you know, the shame of it is, you know, my father is a mathematician who, and it must be a source of great frustration to him that his youngest son is incapable of understanding everything he does.
What is it about, no, you don't understand? Yes. Well,
but the tangible effects of that, I think in some ways your work is more important because it makes it accessible. I mean, in a way, it's an object.
You picked up your dad's work.
Well, it's an object lesson in what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The fact is all these nonlinearities, they talk about the networks in science, in mathematics, even in economics is talked about a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the real changes are being driven by the kinds of things you're talking about, the socialization
of
those perspectives.
Yeah.
And I don't want this to sound too abstract. Essentially, in a sense, what you're talking about is what a lot of us have heard of as 6 degrees or 5 degrees or 4 degrees of separation.
Yes.
It's that connectedness amongst all these pieces and the networks that develop
and
between people.
In the book, I talk about, you know, that concept of 6 degrees of separation comes from a very specific experiment that was done in the 1960s, and in which someone actually sat down, Stanley Milgram sat down, a famous psychologist, sat down and tried to figure out how connected human beings are. And he did an experiment where he took a random group of people who lived out in the Midwest, I think in Nebraska, in Omaha, and he gave them the address of a stockbroker who lived outside of Boston, and he had them... He said, he put the stockbroker's name and address on a piece of paper. He said, mail a piece of paper to somebody who you think will get you closer to the stockbroker. When all the letters finally got to the stockbroker, he was able to see how many people, every time you got the letter, you wrote your name down. He was able to see how many steps it took. And it took it averaged about 5 or 6 steps. That's where we get that concept. Now, that's an amazing idea for two reasons. One is that if you ask people, how many steps do you think would take to get from Omaha, Nebraska to Boston, they'll say 200. Mm-hmm. No one would ever imagine it was so low. But the second interesting thing that he showed is that when you take all of these pieces of paper with all these names on it that come from a random set of people way out in the Midwest, what you find is the same names coming up again and again and again. There are these hubs, these key people, and information funnels through them. And to know who those hubs are, those key people, that's power.
You have some theories about how those people do what they do, too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that when we come back in just a moment with Malcolm Gladwell. Bill Russell and I are with him at The New Yorker in New York City. We'll all be back in a moment.